McCrate versus Auburn Bank. Take your time. I know it takes a minute to transition. Ms. Leonard, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Heather Leonard, and along with Alicia Haynes, we have the honor and pleasure of representing Julia McWright and Becky Wester in their claims against their former employer, Auburn Bank. Just last month, this Court wrote in Berry versus Crestwood Healthcare LP, to survive summary judgment, an employee must present a story supplemented by supported by evidence that would allow a reasonable jury to find that an employer engaged in unlawful retaliation against an employee. In so doing, the Court put to rest the dispute about whether or not McDonnell Douglas is the sole way to proceed with a lot of claims, and provided that the metaphor of a convincing mosaic basically means that so long as a plaintiff presents circumstantial evidence providing that inference of discrimination or retaliation, they have carried their burden at summary judgment.
For what it's worth, I don't think that was new. I think that's been the case for a long time.
I would agree. The problem is exactly as Judge Abudu recognized in her concurrence. Because of the unpublished opinions that dealt with this dispute, the district courts were left more or less in kind of a Lord of the Flies state of nature situation in trying to reconcile this. There are a lot of opinions that would go through this analysis, but a lot of times we would see either court saying you have to pick which horse you're going to ride on and declare this is the evidentiary framework I'm going to use, or flat out just conflate the two. We still, though, have the problem post-Berry, as was recognized in the concurrence, of is the metaphor of a convincing mosaic really an alternative, or is it just another way of establishing a prima facie case under McDonnell Douglas of showing some type of nexus between the employee's protected status or activity and adverse action? And for the convincing mosaic analysis to ring true, to really get back to the text of Title VII, to show that gender is a motivating factor or that age is the but-for cause of a discrimination claim, we really do just need to look at, is there sufficient circumstantial evidence to support an inference of discriminatory or retaliatory intent? And that's what we have here. Specifically, if we look at Ms. McWright's claims, we'll start with her. My intent, for what it's worth, was to go through the evidence that we have that's circumstantial evidence creating that inference of discrimination, and then trying to tackle the issue of whether or not pretext needs to be proven in these circumstances, and to the extent that it is, to provide you with the evidence that we have with that.
So I think we're familiar with the evidence, and one question that I have is whether there's any evidence that King or Herring knew about the complaints.
Direct evidence where they admit to it? No. Circumstantial evidence? Yes.
And what's that?
Okay, if you can give me 1 second. I apologize. Because of the volume of evidence, I got a lot of stuff up here. This is what happens when I try to overorganize myself. With respect to Ms. McWright's claim, we have her complaining to Human Resources and then Human Resources creating a memo documenting the complaint. Admittedly, the memo does not document that Ms. McWright complained of age discrimination, but it seems reasonable that she has told Human Resources that this is her complaint of age discrimination, that it would have been discussed in the context with King about her complaint. And we know that this is a reasonable inference for 3 reasons. First, prior to Ms. McWright's complaint, she's not the only person that has complained of age discrimination. We also have Ms. Sandlin. And Ms. Sandlin's complaints rose to the level that when she was terminated prior to Ms. McWright, Auburn Bank actually gets her to sign a release releasing her age discrimination claims. Second, part of what Ms. McWright's complaints were about was that Mr. King was labeling her a troublemaker and was referring to rumors that she had sued Auburn Bank. This is a reference to the fact that she had previously retained an attorney, Julian McPhillips, who wrote letters to Auburn Bank complaining of age discrimination. Inherent in his rumors of she sued Auburn Bank is him acknowledging at least knowledge of the prior complaints of discrimination. But finally, a reasonable inference from this is a human resources manager who receives a complaint of discrimination is going to investigate that, which at a minimum is going to be to ask people that. For that reason, the circumstances...
Was Mr. King?
Yes.
And did he? What did he say?
He does not admit to knowing this. And that is part of why the circumstances of this case allow us to infer that there is knowledge there.
But if you could infer that he has knowledge, is there ever a situation when you could not infer that the supervisor had knowledge of a claim?
I'm not sure I follow your question, but really what this is it's a disputed fact. While it's not a published opinion of this case, it's actually a case in which Judge Hull sat in Boutwell versus Federal Mogul. There was a situation where an employee was terminated for not reporting to work while on jury duty. She claimed she called in and left a message on the company's phone line, "I'm going to be out for jury duty." The company denied knowledge of that, so we never got the message. We don't know about it. This court, in that opinion, said this is a classic swearing match. There are circumstances from which you can infer that they did receive the complaint. One inference is that the employer is not telling the truth. Another inference is that they didn't hear it. Here,
but you still have the evidence that she says that she left the message. Here, did anyone in HR say that they communicated to Mr. King?
They did not. However, in Breda versus Wolf Camera, this court said that we can infer a court has actual or constructive knowledge if an employee makes a complaint to the person or persons designated under the policy, which is exactly what happened here. And that's why, a la Breda, there is circumstantial evidence from which a jury could find knowledge. The court drew
that. But could a jury find knowledge based on any evidence? I mean, my problem is that I'm not seeing the evidence. So we have plenty of cases where an employee has made a complaint and we found that the supervisor was not aware of that. So there wasn't a retaliation claim. So the rule can't be that any time an employee makes a complaint, we assume that the supervisor must have heard about it. So we need more, I think.
And Your Honor, I think that is here. I mean, first of all, going back to the Breda analysis, we have Ms. McWright complaining to people designated to receive complaints. Under Breda, that is enough to conclude there's actual or constructive knowledge to the employer and to the decision maker. I think at that point, it becomes a jury's question whether the denial of knowledge is reasonable or credible. That involves weighing evidence, and that involves making a factual determination, which is not something that's appropriate at the summary judgment level. But secondly, under these circumstances, when there is a reference to the spreading of the rumors, at a minimum, there is evidence that Mr. King knew of Ms. McWright's earlier complaints of age discrimination if he's telling people she sued the company, referencing the letter she had sent through her attorney at that time.
But is she claiming retaliation for those earlier complaints or retaliation for these later complaints?
It's cumulative. It's all of it. That she is complaining. I don't think you can separate the two. While it involves different things she's complaining of age discrimination, it is all still protected activity. It is all still him labeling her as a troublemaker because she dared to voice opposition to things that she felt in good faith to be unlawful. With respect to Ms. Wester, it's a similar situation. That Ms. Wester's complaint is, you know, ultimately is combined with her requesting a transfer away from Ms. Herring. Ms. Herring, again, denies knowledge. And here, there's a concession that there's a discussion about that Human Resources discusses with Ms. Herring while they're discussing Ms. Wester's termination, that Ms. Wester has sought a transfer. It's reasonable under those circumstances to conclude that discussion would include Ms. Wester's earlier complaint. But the common denominator here is these complaints all go to Human Resources, and then Human Resources is talking to the decision maker. Human Resources has an obligation to get to the bottom of these complaints. It is a reasonable inference from the fact that they received a complaint and then are talking to the people that the complaints are about.
I'm sorry. I want to ask two questions. One about the timing. There's a statement in the record that Mr. King communicated during a meeting his preference to hire and recruit younger people, but my understanding is that comment was made about 18 months before she was terminated. Is that not too tenuous in terms of a connection?
Not at all, Your Honor. Just as close temporal proximity in and of itself is not always going to be dispositive to prove causation, the absence of it does not negate a finding of causation. In high school, we all read Alexander Dumas's The Count of Monte Cristo. We're Southern. Grudges last decades. To think that suddenly somebody shakes it off within 24 hours, 2 months, 3 months is not reasonable, and that ignores human knowledge. It just ignores human nature.
Let's talk about Ms. McCrate's employment history in terms of work performance. There were some would say costly errors that were committed. What was her employment, file before that? Any complaints about other serious errors, or this just happened to be a coincidence that Mr. King's, preference for recruiting young people also happened around the same time that these costly errors were made?
Well, that actually gets into a disputed area. Ms. McCrate's testimony is going to be, I had a strong performance record. I wasn't being counseled. The appellee argued in its brief and its summary judgment, there was this prior written warning dealing with an issue to her. However, their citation to the evidence stops short of going to the person who then concedes, well, we don't know if this warning was ever actually given to her. And Ms. McCrite says, I never got this warning. So I think that there's conflicting evidence that's really for the jury to resolve about her employment history leading up to that point.
And then finally, at least for me, the convincing mosaic issue, as you said, I wrote my concurrence. I'm developing my ideas around that theory analysis. But I am curious about magic words and whether or not the phrase convincing mosaic, especially to the extent that the analysis, some would say, is similar to the McDonnell Douglas framework, is that enough to use key terms, or is it that indeed convincing mosaic is the phrase to be used to clearly preserve that argument?
I'm going to answer your question. I apologize. And it's going to seem like it's going a long way around. But a lot of it goes back to the Groff case that we saw from the Supreme Court this summer, where they basically chastised the courts for decades of taking dicta and turning it into dogma. And that's part of the problem, is once labels get put on some of these frameworks, they suddenly become intractable and take on a life of their own. I think the approach really is ultimately going to the language of the statutes. Is there circumstantial evidence that shows in a gender claim it's a motivating factor, and an age claim showing that age, is the reason or the but-for cause? I think getting down to circumstantial evidence and breaking out so much of these frameworks, but looking at the totality of the evidence. Pretext may be appropriate in some circumstances, but as this court has recognized, it's not appropriate in all.
Are you familiar with the recent Osman case from this court?
I am.
I'll direct your attention to a line that says, the convincing mosaic inquiry is identical to the final stage of the McDonnell Douglas framework. Both ask whether there is enough evidence for a reasonable jury to infer intentional discrimination. Would you say that answers kind of the point that you're making?
I think that is incorrect, though. And that is part of the problem. When we get down to the pretext analysis and it coming out of McDonnell Douglas, and I do see I'm over time. I don't mind this coming out of the McDonnell Douglas standard was developed, under different language under Title VII, not the motivating factor analysis that we have from the 91 amendments, but also at a time that the judge served as the dual role of both the fact finder and the judge of the law. So a lot of times when the courts were hearing these cases, they were wearing both hats at that time. And so we see the McDonnell Douglas framework for analyzing evidence coming out of that. Unfortunately, after the 91 amendments, the law was slow to catch up to the new text under Title VII. And that's part of what we see this court doing in Quigg, is recognizing, okay, motivating factor is not always going to require a pretext analysis, because we just have to show that it is part of the analysis. But when we get down to it, the pretext analysis comes down to this. The employer is saying, I don't have a discriminatory motive. I have a legitimate motive, or my intent is legitimate. Here is what we're presenting. Well, at the same time, the plaintiff is presenting circumstantial evidence from which a jury could reject that motive. And I think sometimes requiring a plaintiff to hit that head on ignores the weight of the circumstantial evidence that can be out there. And that is why I think the language that we see from the Berry opinion on the issue of pretext of when it says pretext requires the employee to present evidence that casts doubt on the employer's proffered reason as the only reason for its action, citing to yelling. I think that is, if we're going to apply pretext analysis, the more appropriate way to do it. Does it cast doubt? There can be a weight of evidence, which we sort of see through this convincing mosaic metaphor, that gets us to that point. But ultimately, what we see from the Berry opinion is when an employer offers abundant and uncontroverted independent evidence that no retaliation occurred, the employer will be awarded summary judgment. Here.
Thank you. I think we've got your argument.
Can I just ask her one thing? As I understand it, you contend there is a difference between the McDonnell Douglas, not only burden shifting, but pretext and convincing mosaic. There may be some overlap in what you look at, but you maintain there are two different standards, so to speak. Is that correct?
I would like there to be, Your Honor. I think the practical way this court is...
I understand you want it to be, go back to the statute, and we just look at everything, and it's one thing, and just Chuck might not... I understand that,
yeah.
But I'm saying right now, under the law, you understand that they seem to be, at least right now, two different standards, even though there may be some overlap. Is that correct?
The way I read the law, they basically provide alternate ways to get that first prima facie showing, either through the familiar McDonnell Douglas elements, or the
convincing
nexus between the two.
All right. I just want to make sure I'm clear about this. In the district court, you really relied on McDonnell Douglas and did not argue convincing mosaic, but maybe I have that wrong.
Your Honor, we may not have used those exact words
but you never used the word convincing mosaic, but you maybe argued all around the kind of substance of it.
All of the arguments we're making in support of that metaphor were made at the district court.
And I know Berry says they are the same thing and they're just two arguments on the same issue, but I have found precedent, I'm going to ask counsel about it, that says they aren't. They're very different, that precedes Berry. Okay.
And
there's a lot of precedent published before Berry that says they aren't the same thing. And if you don't raise one, you don't raise the other. So what do you say to us? Let's assume Berry has got a misstatement there. It doesn't cite all these old cases. What would you say is that you, in effect, raised it even though you never raised the words,
correct,
used the words?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christina Pantazis on behalf of Appellees Auburn Bank, Auburn National Bank Corporation, and Mr. King, who is here with us today. Judge Huffaker's order granting summary judgment in favor of Appellees should be affirmed for a number of reasons, which are set forth in our response brief. This is particularly true, though, for four reasons. First, the appellants, Rebecca Wester and Julia McCrite, cannot show that the legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for their termination were pretextual. Second, the appellants did not present their convincing mosaic age discrimination analysis to the district court because they, and even if they had not waived it before the district court, the metaphor does not allow a reasonable juror to find that age was the but-for cause of their termination. Finally, Julia McCrite did not properly plead or raise a mixed motive sex discrimination claim, so the claim must fail. And finally, as this court discussed with Ms. Leonard, the McDonnell Douglas prima facie retaliation claim fails because they did not present any evidence that the decision makers knew about their complaints.
I have a question that I had intended to ask the other side, and we got off track. But do you think for a mixed motive claim, setting aside whether she raised one or not, do you think that you can raise a mixed motive claim with two illegal justifications, or do you think one justification needs to be legitimate and then the other justification needs to be illegitimate and a violation of the law?
I think it can be either or, Your Honor. I believe this court has found a number of times that you can raise a a mixed motives claim. There's a lot of overlapping terms. You can raise a mixed motive claim, for example, for being a black female, which would both be protected characteristics. And I believe the court in Bostock said that you could have a scenario where there was a woman who was a Yankees fan and you could not discriminate against women who were Yankees fans, but you could terminate any Yankees fan overall. So I think that it is possible to raise both. However, in order to raise a mixed motive claim, you do have to, or a motivating factor claim, which is different than an intersectional claim, you have to acknowledge that there is a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the termination. As this court found in Quigg, the reason that the McDonnell-Douglas framework doesn't apply to a motivating factor claim is because the two are incompatible. You can't have, in a motivating factor claim, you're always going to have a legitimate non-discriminatory reason because the protected reason was only part of that analysis and was only a contributing factor rather than the but-for cause. But you can have an intersectional claim where it is the but-for cause for the termination. And that would require applying the single motive frameworks like Judge Huffaker did at the district court.
In terms of the facts of this case, do you all dispute, and recognizing that you can't rely simply on statistics, that at one point before Mr. King, or when he started, the department was 75% roughly women, 25% roughly men, and then during his tenure and at the time that the plaintiff was terminated, that totally flipped, 75% now men, only 25% women. Is that accurate?
That's accurate in the context of the gender discrimination claim, Your Honor. In the context of the age discrimination claim, I believe that you have to take, obviously, gender out of it and look at age. And Mr. King did hire some older mortgage loan originators, including John Sonmore, who is older than...
Older meaning what? Because I also saw in the record where, although I would dispute that 40s is old, that there were folks in their 40s who were terminated. So when you say older, because age discrimination is at issue, what were the ages of those individuals?
John Sonmore was a year older than Ms. McCright. He was 63 and hired shortly after her termination as the construction loan originator. Julia McCright and Rebecca Westers, turning to the pretext question, Julia McCright and Rebecca Westers' failure to do their jobs honestly exposed Auburn Bank to unnecessary risk and also undermined their confidence that they would comply with the bank's regulations and governmental regulations in the future. Julia McCright sent an unauthorized commitment letter to an unqualified borrower, which the bank believed bound it to make the loan. Ms. McCright tries to challenge that reason as pretext by saying that the letter did not actually bind the bank and that it could have gotten out of making the loan to the borrower. However, the issue is not whether the underlying facts of the discharge are true. It's whether the bank reasonably believed them. And the undisputed evidence here shows that Auburn Bank actually made the loan to Mr. Ori, that the CEO of the bank, Mr. Dumas, testified that they would not have made that loan had it not been for the letter that Julia McCright sent. And she admitted she had no authority to approve the loan, yet sent a letter telling the borrower he was approved.
Was that the first time that something like that, recognizing it was a costly mistake, had happened at the bank?
As far as committing a borrower via letter, or committing the bank to make a loan to an unqualified borrower, as far as the decision makers went, yes. And that's the only evidence of any MLO doing that in the record. She's the only one who used that letter. And finally, Mr. King sent a letter in June before Ms. McCright even filed her EEOC charge, recapping why the bank made the loan, why it felt it was obligated to make the loan, and ultimately that was the reason that Ms. McCright was fired. Turning to Ms. Rebecca Wester, she knowingly allowed to let a loan close without doing the verbal verification of employment, which was her job and her job alone. She challenges that that reason is pretextual by arguing that the bank didn't lose any money, that the borrower ended up making more money after she transferred jobs and therefore is no harm, no foul. However, the bank can't allow money to be committed to borrowers without making sure that they actually qualify for the loan and that they can pay the loan back. That's a serious mistake. And she's done nothing to show that she did not commit or did not actually perform the VOE. She actually admits that she didn't do that. As the court acknowledged earlier, the appellants did not use the words convincing mosaic in their argument at the district court, and in fact separated their age discrimination claim into an original into an initial argument discussing comparator evidence and then moving on to a pretext analysis, which addresses the McDonnell-Douglas framework that we all are very familiar with. Even though the defendants raised the convincing mosaic in both of their opening summary judgment briefs, plaintiffs did not contest the convincing mosaic analysis in their response brief and then raised it for the first time on appeal, which prior precedent in this
court. What did they do in the district court if they didn't contest convincing mosaic? What did they argue?
In our opening briefs, we argued both McDonnell-Douglas and convincing mosaic, and they have a section on age discrimination that first discusses comparator evidence and then discusses pretext. It makes no mention of convincing mosaic.
It was all McDonnell-Douglas argument.
Yes. And
okay.
The court, actually resolved Ms. Wester's complaint by finding that she could present a convincing mosaic, could present a prima facie case under McDonnell-Douglas.
Right, because of the comparators.
That's correct.
We're not similarly comparable.
That's correct, which would mean that she wouldn't need to travel under the convincing mosaic framework. And
or the pretext either.
She could not meet the pretext prong of
that. Right. Can I go back through the claims on gender to make sure I've got this right? The district court rejected that she made a gender claim, and she doesn't challenge that ruling on appeal. Is that wrong?
I believe at the district court, Judge Huffaker found that she did not make a motivating factor Title VII claim, but
okay.
Did make a but-for, a single motive framework claim, and now analyze that under both.
As to gender?
Yes.
Okay. So it was not a single motive claim, it was a mixed motive claim as to gender.
The opposite, Your Honor.
Just the opposite. Okay, yes. So a single motive claim.
There are far too many frameworks.
Okay.
That
yeah, that's why I wanted to go through and make sure I understand it. So what did he rule on that as to the single motive claim?
He analyzed both the McDonnell-Douglas and convincing mosaic frameworks and found that Ms. McCrite was not able to establish a but-for causation.
And because of?
Because of, I believe on the McDonnell-Douglas, he found that she could not find a comparator and also there was no pretext.
Okay.
And then analyzed the same claims under the motivating factor standard, or under the convincing mosaic standard. Would you like to continue, Your Honor, through the other?
Yeah, and then let's go to the age. So as to age, McDonnell-Douglas was abandoned. Is that right?
Convincing mosaic was abandoned, Your Honor.
Okay, convincing, okay. Probably forfeited in the district court. I'm looking at my notes. Okay.
Yes.
So.
And the court analyzed both appellant's claims under the McDonnell-Douglas framework.
Okay. And both as, did it go to pretext, or he just said there was no prima facie case?
He found that both could not meet the standard for pretext.
Okay.
He pretermitted discussion of Ms. McCrite's prima facie case because he found pretext.
Okay, so he didn't really do pretext under the age.
He did pretext under age.
Okay.
He did prima facie case for Ms. Wester, but not for Ms. McCrite, finding
okay.
that he could dispose of the claims under pretext.
Okay.
And then I believe the remaining claims were not appealed. Those are the only ones that are
before okay.
this court. As for the convincing mosaic analysis, as far as on the merits, the primary reason that it fails is because the plaintiffs cannot show that the reasons were pretextual. In Berry, Judge Pryor did note that where the defendant presents a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, the plaintiff must address it. And here, plaintiffs have done nothing to address those reasons that were very serious violations of bank policy and show that they were false and that the real reason was terminated.
Well, in Berry, you had like 16 people who were being supervised by Ms. Berry who complained about her conduct, and she did have a few things in her employee file that suggested employee issues. Here, from what I understand, again, from the record, there were one or two serious instances over a 20-plus year career with the bank. Again, how does that rise to the level of termination?
Your Honor, prior to Mr. King's arrival at the bank, Ms. McCright had a serious history of employment violations. Those were all addressed in Ms. Carrington's declaration, which had a number of the infractions listed. We also addressed those with Ms. McCright during her deposition. And then once Mr. King came to the bank, he said his charge was there to take a mortgage department that was not functioning correctly and make it better and turn it around. Ms. McCright, or when Mr. King arrived at the bank, he decided that he wouldn't look at the performance history prior to his arrival and would make his own opinions based on what happened there at the bank when he was there. And through that time, Ms. McCright, she was divisive among the employees. She would encourage the processing staff to come to her with questions instead of going to their manager, which he was trying to encourage them to go to the operations staff. She would refuse to make call reports where Mr. King would ask that the employees make weekly call reports. And she said that she just had too much loan volume already and wasn't going to do that. And she also had an issue with a separate borrower earlier on that was a serious issue to the bank. Where she tried to change the rate of a mortgage loan shortly before the closing, which would have made it unsellable to Fannie Mae. And the issue wasn't so much that she had gone against the regulations as much as what she tried to do behind the bank's back in trying to change the mortgage rate prior to termination.
This was the bartender or
No. These were just two borrowers who the rate was disclosed at 0.5% less than what the rate on the loan should have been. And while that was a costly mistake, the bigger issue was what she tried to do in order to correct it. And the bank caught her in the act. And she was advised at that point that any further issues in with bank loans would lead to her termination. Although Ms. McCright says that she recognizes that the meeting happened and she recognizes that she didn't see the write-up, which we must accept is true, but she never disputed that she was warned that another infraction would lead to her termination. And then, of course, the ORI loan on its own, Mr. King testified several times that that on its own is reason enough for termination. And it's not the court's job to sit as the super personnel department and review whether that is or whether the bank's judgment was correct or wise. It's whether it reasonably held that. And again, the bank clearly reasonably believed that this was a reason for termination. She committed a borrower who was not qualified for a mortgage loan to a loan, and they had to loan the money to her, and they reasonably believed that they had to do that.
Okay, and I'm sorry. So then the bartender was the issue where the bank itself had to provide the loan because the person wouldn't qualify through the other lender.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. The bank had gone through established and I'll probably go over my time. I apologize if you allow me to continue. The bank had gone through and reviewed their pre-qualification versus pre-approval letters prior in the year. And while Ms. McCright says that she didn't see that pre-qualification letter, the fact that they held, she does not dispute that they held two meetings, that the emails were sent around with the correct letter. As far as Ms. McConnell saying, hey, can I get a copy of the letter that you all discussed in this meeting last week? And so it was reasonable for Mr. King and Ms. Herring to believe that all of the originators were using that letter from that period of time on. They had no knowledge that Ms. McCright was sending out a letter telling bank potential mortgagers that they were approved for a loan. When they had not gone through underwriting, no one else at the bank had looked through. She had only had verbal communications with them about what they made. He could have been lying. He might have been unemployed. And she approved him for a mortgage loan, which the bank saw as satisfactory to enter. End her employment.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Leonard, you've still got your 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, this is a case where just about everything is disputed. I think we agree that the plaintiff, or that Ms. McBride and Ms. Wester worked at Auburn Bank. And then after that, the parties don't agree on much. And that's exactly why this is a case which was inappropriate for summary judgment. I want to go and address the issue of pretext a little bit more fully because I think that that will help the court. I want to start first looking at Ms. McBride. Initially, we need to look at the fact that the letter that she was using was not unknown to Auburn Bank. It's a letter that she had been using in the past, and which Ms. Herring, her new supervisor, she actually emailed and said, can I still keep using this? And had no problems. So it's something that Auburn Bank had reason to believe that she was using, but it did not commit the bank to an unreasonable loan. If you look at the text of her letter and you look at the text of the If you looked at the text of the letter that she was sending out and compare it to the email that the defendant says Mr. King sends out later showing that it was the straw that broke the camel's back, we actually see the things that he's griping about are covered in the letter, specifically docket entry 141-14 at Defendant's Exhibit 7. In the letter that Ms. McWright sends out, she tells Mr. Ori that in order for the loan to go through, he's going to have a satisfactory appraisal, which is item D, and item E, a debt-to-income ratio not to exceed 45% in the time of the loan closing. Later, however, though, when we see Mr. King griping about this in document 141-65 at Plaintiff's Exhibit 241, he complains that he had to go through this loan even though an appraisal had not yet been obtained, and that the debt-to-income ratio was 133%. Ms. McWright's letter did not commit the bank to do anything unless the terms in there had been met. He's the one who decided to go through, and the plaintiff is going to say, as his reasonable inference, to be able to force out an older employee who he then reassigns her book of business to a younger employee and then fast tracks and promotes two younger people to loan originator positions. But more importantly, let's get down to Auburn Bank's policies and why this evidence is pretext. Under their policies, Ms. McWright should have received two written disciplinary warnings. As this court recognized in Patterson versus Georgia Pacific, a failure to follow disciplinary policies can suggest pretext, and it's because those policies create an expectation of what we would see in an employee's personnel file if they're a poor performer or if they're doing things wrong. And when we don't see that documentation in their personnel file, it raises a question about whether that is truly a reason that is motivating this decision. We see no disciplinary actions in Ms. McWright's file, even though Auburn Bank's policies create the expectation it should be there. Therefore, the failure to follow that policy evidences pretext. But further, we also see their policy obligates them to have human resources investigate a recommendation for termination before it's implemented. And that did not happen here. And the reason that is even more troubling is at this point in time, human resources had reason to believe that Mr. King's decisions could have been tainted by unlawful discrimination. Not only because of what we saw with Ms. Sandlin preceding Ms. McWright's termination, but also because of Ms. McWright's complaints to human resources. What we draw from this inference is that Auburn Bank didn't care if there was a legitimate reason for firing. This further suggests pretext.
What about your friend on the other side's notation that Mr. King hired someone who was actually older than Ms. McWright after her termination?
I'm glad you brought that up. He complained of age discrimination. John Sonmore complained of age discrimination. He also testified that Mr. King bragged about firing Ms. Sandlin, Ms. Wester, and Ms. McWright. His situation does not negate an inference of age discrimination. It actually bolsters it because he says, I experienced the exact same problems. But his hiring also further supports the intersectional claim that Ms. McBride has advanced for gender and age discrimination. Because we see that Mr. Sonmore was actually the one who was ultimately responsible for making sure in the Wester situation that the employment verification occurred. He was not disciplined for that. These are the problems that we see within the case, that we had a manager or we had a bank president, Mr. King, take over and say, basically, out with the old and with the new. And over the course of the next 18 months, he implements it. But the other thing I did want to address, when you were speaking with my friends on the other side, you raised the issue about costly mistakes. And if we look at the comparator evidence as it relates to Drew Goodner and Blake Otwell.
I hope you'll try to be quick on this because okay. Your time is up.
It cost the bank millions. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll move to our next case.